Hello, I'm Declan Mead, and I'm the publisher of the Stinging Fly magazine, and you're listening to the Stinging Fly podcast. In every episode, we ask a writer to read a story from our archives, and afterwards we discuss the story, the art of writing, and their own work. Today, I'm joined by Oisin Fagan. Oisin's first novel, Nobber, was published earlier this year by John Murray. Nobber is set in Ireland during the plague, and it's a funny, dark, smart, and beautifully written take on historical fiction. Oisin is also the author of Hostages, a short story collection published by New Ireland, and a novella, The Hierophants. Oisin has chosen today to read Hey, a short story by David Hayden, which we published in our spring 2010 issue, and which appeared in David's debut collection, Darker with the Lights On. Hope you enjoy the story and the chat. Here's Oisin with Hey.
Andy straightens his hat and listens to the carriage song. Long metallic E's and F sharps, grumble rumbles and a shuck shuck shuck, a pause and a shuck shuck shuck. Ochre light holds the interior still and suggests the great brown world outside. Andy shifts tackily on the beige seating. Everything exchanges the super rich heat. Everything is imperfectly at rest. The train scutters over a long bridge that might have been an aqueduct in a country with water. Andy looks rightwards, out at the blue concrete towers that many people live in. The windows seem concrete too, but they cannot be. The train rises to the height of pyramid roofs, corrugated iron with verandas where people store boxes. On one of the verandas, Andy sees a man, a very young man with a beard. He is leaning backwards in a harness, and the harness is roped upwards, and as the man lifts his feet off the floor, he starts to rise. Andy realizes that the man is being lifted into the air by a bale of hay, an ordinary cuboid bale of hay. The man is rising slowly, looking down, keeping his rope clear and his harness steady, always looking down but not noticing that the rope is stroking the rough edge of the iron eaves and that he will surely collide with the roof if he does not kick against the wall or the post. Andy looks away and leftwards to the packs of houses that lie under a different sky, dark blue, rippling. From the windows, people watch the passing train, but they are small and Andy cannot see their faces. No one talks in the carriage. Andy looks at his own hands. Looking rightwards again, the plain is clear except for a dotting of stunted farmhouses and the white sky-searching arms of the gum trees. Far ahead is an enormous tower block. No, it is a mountain-high stack of hay bales shifting from side to side slightly, slowly. The tower looms. It susurrates. Andy feels threatened. He goes to sleep. Andy wakes up and the hay tower is exactly where it was, shouldering its mass in one place as if it has followed him. The train slows and slows and the song ends. Andy squeezes out of the narrow carriage door with his carpet bag and steps soundlessly onto the platform. The train is gone. The sun is flat and white. The colour alone could make the world hot, even without its fire. Andy walks to the main street, walks past the tiled walls of the hotel and stops outside the cafe. A hand-painted sign outside reads, Chew and Spew. He steps inside. The cafe smells good. Long black, please. I'll bring her over. Andy sits down on a detonated sofa in the shade. A blue apron shifts by. A man dips, shows his shiny head and wispy hair and places the coffee on a low table. Food. Maybe later. The man nods, smiles to himself and walks back behind the counter. He starts to polish a glass with his rubber. Aren't you hot in that suit? I suppose I am. Did you need that waistcoat? It goes with the suit. How's the coffee? Fine. Do you mind the questions?
Yes.
Why?
No reason.
Food?
Maybe later.
Andy drinks two-thirds of the coffee hot, waits and drinks the last third cold. He crosses the street in the shadow of the hay tower. The office is opposite, behind a steel door. It is air-conditioned, cool, cold. The receptionist sits still behind her counter, not even pretending to type. She looks at Andy.
Good afternoon, says Andy. I'm here to see Krajek.
Krajek, he's expecting you. What's your name?
Andy. Andy, he's expecting you. Take the stairs.
Why? Is the lift broken?
Andy runs up the stairs and opens the door at the top. He looks out. There is a simple fall to the street. Andy runs down the steps, finds another door and opens it to find a mostly empty room with a man sitting on a large green leather chair with a stool at his feet. In the corner is a tough-looking yard brush.
Mr. Krajek?
Krajek, yes, you must be Andy.
Yes, I must be.
Sit. Andy steps forward and crouches on the stool.
The mine is flooded.
Flooded?
Where did that come from?
The usual place.
But it's so dry in these parts.
Not in the mine it isn't. So the job is to make it dry again.
Do you have any hydraulic equipment? Shinsky pumps? Outflow piping with secure attachments? Diggers for runoff reservoir?
No, nothing like that.
None of it is necessary. You just have to make them stop.
Andy looks at Krajek silently, thinking, make who stop what?
Make the miner stop crying.
But I'm an engineer, I don't...
How you stop them is not my concern. Stop the flooding is all.
Andy replies silently, inconclusively.
I'll pay you to try.
I've never done this kind of work before.
Try.
Where's the mine?
I'll drive you, it's not far.
A snow-like rush of dust and dry grass sweeps around the bubble curves of the car. Scraps of hay and empty golden wrappers litter the floor. A sweet smell of coconut scents the air. Krajek breaks suddenly and opens the door. Andy hears a faint tremor of moaning and steps out of the car. Krajek is already most of the way to a large shack. Tiny pieces of hay shoot and swirl around, forcing Andy to shield his eyes, purse his lips and breathe through his nose. He begins to run and reaches Krajek as he passes through the shack screen door. Krajek shakes himself down and takes off a pair of protective glasses and a mouth mask that Andy had not noticed. Andy wipes his eyes and looks around. The rise and fall of men sobbing finds a shape, each shudder mounting on the others. One man stands in the middle of the room, water planing down his cheeks onto his twisting, outstretched hands. His fingers shine clean in the bare bulb light of the shack. Another weeper stands in a corner, leaning dutifully over a large tub that holds a flourishing bamboo plant. Dozens of men sit on benches at long tables, eating identical meat pies with tomato sauce on top, buckets scattered at their feet. More sit at bar stools, gripping tubes of beer, the floor beneath them slippery with tears. A solitary, tearless woman moves up and down the room with a mop and bucket.
It's bad.
Oh, it gets worse.
How did it start?
It just did.
Have you called a doctor?
He just said it was idiopathic and started crying. Then he billed me for his laundry.
Are all the women not crying?
Yes.
Why don't you hire more women?
We don't do that.
How come you're not crying?
I can't cry. I have to use teardrops.
Krajek takes a golden envelope out of his pocket, slips out the rough brown candy disc and pops it whole into his mouth. It looks uncomfortably large. Andy waits for him to swallow. Krajek swallows.
How long does it take for new miners to start crying?
Varies, usually about 2 weeks.
How long does it take for them to stop when they're off the job?
Varies, usually about 4 weeks.
Why don't you run a shift system, 2 weeks on and 4 weeks off?
That'd triple my wage bill.
At least...
Krajek strokes the back of his head, grimaces and looks up.
I can afford it. I'm already paying time and a half tier money.
Why don't you do it?
Because you've only just thought of it.
What do you want me to do?
Well, I can handle the recruitment and the scheduling. I'd like you to survey the mine, see if there's any damage and get it back to work.
I'll do that.
Andy walks through the haystorm to the mine head, climbs into the cage and descends. The hot soupy air shudders with sobs and low blubbing. The cage falls rapidly and rapidly slows before stopping. Andy rattles the gate open, presses the signal buzzer twice and steps out. A man with a long wet beard appears out of the gloom carrying a lamp and leads Andy down a narrow passage. The walls sparkle. The sound of men crying comes from every direction, growing louder as they half run along with their necks craned to avoid scraping their heads on the roof. Nearly an hour's walk later, Andy sees an orange light up ahead. They are soon standing at the entrance of a great chamber. 1,000 men are sitting or standing, alone or in groups, all weeping in their own ways, their silvery issue sluicing across the floor, a great self-syncopating orchestra of misery. Andy quickly works out that standard pumping equipment will deal with the flooding. Is any work getting done?
Not much.
Working's flooded?
Yeah.
Well, why haven't you got pumping?
The man wipes his beard and shrugs his shoulders.
How can you stand the noise?
After a while, it's like it was always here.
And why don't the men quit?
Pay's good.
Within 2 weeks, Andy has a pumping rig fully operational. A month later, the new shifts are working. There are so many men on the recovery shift that a large camp is built on the edge of town. At night, the men go out into the desert to cry and drink beer. Dazzling flowers begin to rise up through the abandoned tinnies, and soon the bloom is spreading outwards for miles around. Farmers move in and sow the desert with maize and wheat. Fields are planted with spinach, zucchini, pak choi and peppers. The growers reach an agreement with the mine to allow its workers to become shift weepers after spending periods of time underground. During the night, they water the orchards of oranges, lemons and mangoes with their tears. Eventually, the men desiccate and have to return to the city to rehydrate, but there are always enough people to take their place. Andy returns some years later and stays at the new resort hotel. He stands on the balcony and looks out at the gentle shifting tower of hay. The sound of discreet crying arrives with the odour of ripening fruit, and silhouetted against the high, yellow moon is a solitary man held aloft by a bale of hay.
Thank you, Oisin, for reading the story. Can you tell us a little bit about, perhaps why you chose it and also what you like about the story?
I chose it because it's unique. I don't think I've ever read anything like it, definitely not coming from an Irish author. Maybe in a more global context, it would remind me a little bit of maybe some kind of French Nouvelle Romance stuff, or it's a modernist fairy tale. The imagery is very striking, very worked on. The symbols are very strong, but they kind of don't configure together. And parts of it remind me of maybe a Bob Dylan song from the 60s or a Charlie Chaplin film. It's very, very funny, and you can think about it for a long time.
Yeah. So I was reading an interview with David where he was talking about his process for writing stories would be to, you know, take a lot of the identifiers out, you know, in terms of place names or just regular, like anything that would smack of maybe, you know, that would be overly familiar to the reader. So he's kind of taking those things out in order to build this other type of world, perhaps. Mm. Can you see that at work in this story?
Yeah, definitely. The stories are they're stark in the sense that they're kind of series of conversations and images. And you can imagine someone working out this world fully and then cutting and cutting and cutting until it becomes this kind of dreamscape. I think that's why they kind of resist interpretation so much and they have a kind of sticking power. I mean, I could try a few interpretations with them in different ways, but you definitely get this feeling that there are a series of strong images being pulled together. Now, that might be the result of him writing a 50-page kind of outline and then taking these pieces, or it might be that these are just these haunting images that deserve to be in a story.
And would you describe the writing here as experimental, or how do you feel about that tag about in writing anyway?
It's excellent writing. I think that's the only brand of writing. I would say the way the stories are put together, the way the scenes are struck together, and the activities of the story are new.
Yeah.
Or stark. So, yeah, sure, why not experimental?
But is that the type of writing or the thinking behind writing that appeals to you, or...?
I like things that aren't boring, and this story is not boring at all. You need a certain level of concentration. You kind of have to interrupt the flow. It's a kind of syncopated thing. So what appeals to me is things that are exciting and different, and this story has that in spades. I mean, you go through a kind of whole economic development. You go through the creation of a city, and then it's strung together by this image of hay. It's remarkable.
Yeah. And I suppose there is a sense of this kind of building of a world within the writing, so that, you know, this world has been presented to us, but it's a world that we have to, that the writer has created and that we are being introduced to, and we kind of have to find our way in it very quickly.
Mm.
Because it's not quite our world, mm-hmm. although it's obviously close to it.
Mm.
So is that something, you know, in terms of your own work that you... I'm trying to get at, the relationship between you as a reader and you as a writer, and how one feeds into the other.
I like excellent writing, and the world building stuff. Right, what David Hayden does, and I appreciate it very much, and I try to do this as well, is he does a defamiliarization. So he takes a series of tropes that would be recognizable, but he makes them crazy by what he leaves out or what he puts in. And to me, kind of going along his stories, what I really like is everything in his world seems to be very, very heavily symbolic. But it's so symbolic, actually, that it's kind of crazy. Like, it's not the real world. And the symbols are defying you to read them, but at the end, like, they always resist this meaning put upon them. And that is the aspect of his work that I like or share,
yes.
I feel.
Yeah. And can you talk about that a bit, maybe in relation to Nobber and the writing of that?
I suppose in Nobber, you're definitely people are trying to find out what symbols mean or what the meaning of their affliction is.
Yeah.
And they try to pin different meanings on it, and some of the meanings move away from them, and then some of the meanings they embrace, and that's where their activity is generated from. So especially in Nobber, there's one or two images that I'm quite proud of, but they can be read in different ways, and the characters read them in different ways, but still you're never entirely sure. Maybe I know what they are, but yeah. I hope the reader is kind of still guessing. One is, there's a thing of crows. It's a kind of image or a structure that is kind of there, kind of to taunt the reader. It's kind of nightmare form. And the other is, there's a knocking on the door. And these things, to me, they have a specific meaning. But like David does in his story, if you remove certain sentences, their meaning becomes much more fluid, but then the image that they're placed in, is it becomes much starker.
Mm. And, you know, so with David's story, I mean, there's we always talk about this, the short story, you know, being this about distillation and, you know, concentrating on a single moment, or and therefore the language is very precise, and obviously with David that's very much the case. You know, how does that relate to the writing of a novel for you, in terms of, you know, you've written stories and novels, but like, was part of the appeal of moving to the novel for you the more space or more room to maneuver through language, I suppose, or story?
It definitely allows you to elaborate or seek variations on a theme, which the short story, often you must make a choice,
yeah,
of the theme or the moment. Often in the short story, is these gravitate around moments, whereas with the novel you can more fully explore these images or these relationships and stuff like that. So that is very appealing. And
What is great in the novel is you get to see the build-up, the creation, the shift, and things like that, whereas the short story is always asking you to imagine that this is an end point of something that matters, whereas a novel gets to, you get to show that, and oftentimes that's the kind of, it's the pleasure of the journey or something like that. Yeah. I find, I say this, but now I'd often find that when we say these things, like the short story and the novel, they resist these things you say about
sure.
them. Like say, for example, David Hayden's story, like it's very full. It's covering clearly a period of a few years.
Yeah.
And it happens, I'd say, in 7 or 8 pages. So it's very full, and you have all the tropes you would have in longer novels. Like you have a fixer character coming in, you have the development of a town, you know, so that short story does not function in the way a classic 19th century short story functions. It's more like, to me, it's more like a kind of modernist comedic take on an old tale or like a history. And the short story allows you to do that. So, yeah.
At what point did you realize that you were writing the novel, you know, the world? At what point did you decide that that was the world you were going to write your novel in?
When I decided it was going to be the novel, or when I decided it was going to be Nobber?
Nobber, the world of Nobber, or the time period and the subject matter. Or when did you think it was, oh, this is going to be a novel as opposed to a story? Or
okay, well, there's kind of, I suppose there's two different stories there. So the first was a friend of mine called Finbar Dwyer, a comrade of mine probably. He wrote a book on the plague in Ireland, and it was the first book, I think it's the first book-length treatment of the plague.
Yeah.
So anyway, I read that. I thought it was interesting. I never really thought about the plague at all. If you'd asked me my first novel was going to be about the plague, I would have laughed you out of the place. And then I went on holidays in Kerry, and I was walking around the Ring of Kerry, and I kind of just had this idea that where I was walking probably hadn't changed so much in 700 or 800 years, and that walking through Ireland was essentially the same experience, and I felt this huge connection with the past and all that kind of transcendent stuff. And I said, sure, I'd give it a go, configuring through my interests of, like, you know, a rapacious, greedy kind of guy. Now, when it became a novel, was there's a kind of A to B to the novel, where lads are going into town and then they're coming out of town, and that's it, that's the journey. But then Nobber itself is why it had to be a novel, because I wanted to show the townspeople, I wanted to show what it meant to the townspeople, and then going through the townspeople involved novel length treatment.
Yeah. Well, apparently David Hayden is working on a novel at the moment. I'm not sure how far along he is with that, but you know, sometimes with short story writers, I think, you know, how amazingly generous they are, or spendthrift in a way, that they give away so much within the context of a story, as opposed to, you know, I mean, this could easily be something that could be, could run to novel length.
Oh, it's a thankless task writing short stories. You won't, you'll get your reward in heaven.
Well, actually, I wanted to talk to you a bit about the general thanklessness of writing, maybe. And, you know, how you feel about that. You know, I mean, or you published your novel in the summer, and that's your first novel, but you also published a novella and a book of stories prior to that. So that's 3 books out in the world. And, you know, have you experienced the kind of book hangover thing with any of those books? Or
what's a book hangover?
Well, as in the kind of, you know, maybe a slight sense of anticlimax about the getting out a book out, and then kind of just kind of coming back down into reality and
reality.
Or what we know is reality, and then kind of, you know, I'm picking yourself up again and saying, okay, well, okay, I'm gonna get back to work. And what is it that motivates, has kept, you know, keeps you going, and where do you see it kind of going from now? You know, I suppose this is a general question I'd ask to any writer, but
it is the question.
Yeah.
Book hangover, I mean, you spend your whole life wanting to write books and then they come out and you're kind of going, is this it? But, you know, you could say that about any aspect of your life. I do think you need an element of faith because it's like you say, that if it's just like, why, you're not doing it for some kind of career reason, are you? You're not doing it because you're going to get on the Late Late Show or something like this, or, you know, a ticket to the Oscars. You're doing it because you believe in the form, and you must believe that the form is vast enough and great enough and meaningful enough to contain your life and your efforts.
Yeah.
And for that, you need faith. You need faith in the novel or the short story in literature. Like, I hear a lot of people kind of now, we're kind of living in a wellness era where people are saying, like, writing is my therapy, it's who I am. Writing can be very torturous, and it doesn't lead to a more complete human. It certainly doesn't lead to a more complete bank account. It doesn't lead to any of these things. So you must believe in literature, I think. Now, some people say you must believe in the reader. I don't. The reader knows what you tell them, you know?
But can you remember a point when this kind of hit home for you? Or, like, you know, you say that you can't expect to have necessarily a career, or that's not the aim or the the objective. But it must have been starting out at some point. You know, were your expectations, did you have to reset your expectations along the way?
Yeah, I've wanted to be a writer since I was 12, and it's all I've ever wanted. And then that's linked to the idea of there's, what's it called? Not goalposts, checkpoints. Yeah. Where it's like you get your first short story published.
A milepost.
Yeah, milepost, something like that. Yeah, checkpoints. Like, that's like Sonic the Hedgehog, right? He gets checkpoints. You're going through these different stages, and at every stage, you're saying, why isn't this bigger, or why isn't this better? Or you're saying, why am I lucky like this and so many others aren't? So you have all these questions going around, and you need to always be kind of going back to base level. So maybe with some people, I know I've talked to some people, they want to create the feeling of being 14 or 15 when you were reading those great books for the first time.
Yeah.
And like, that's, you hold that moment in your head, and that kind of gets you through whatever, you know, maybe not bad reviews, but like, if you're not reviewed, or if you don't, you're not being read so widely, or, you know, you send a book out there and where's it gone?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you don't know what's happening with the book. Yeah. So you're still there on your own, waking up in the same bed. So you need to have faith.
Yes.
You need to hold on to the reasons why you started doing this. And maybe if the reasons aren't still there, you know, take a break.
Yeah.
Don't do it. You don't have to be a writer all the time. Sometimes you can just be an idiot wandering around the place, you know, getting coffee. I don't know.
Well, we had Mia Gallagher give a lecture at Bray Literary Festival there a couple of weeks ago. And so she chose the topic of product, practice and process. Those three P's, which I may have gotten the wrong order there, but, you know, in terms of product, I mean, a kind of realization over the journey of her career up, well, we use that word, to date, kind of realizing that, you know, you don't really have all that much control about the product, you know, the product that you produce and that has to go into the marketplace, and then the product of yourself, you know, in terms of, you know, how you present yourself in terms of to a public or a potential readership. And then just finding the strength to go on by concentrating on making the product as good as she can make it. You know, and that's what she's come to believe is what, you know, certainly motivates her to continue and gives her the faith to keep going is to concentrate on the product in that way and not to concentrate on how other people receive the product.
Oh, yeah.
It's about how much work she puts into the product itself. And that's the element that she control, and the element that she derives her satisfaction from. So I don't know if that, I think that It's more of a comment than a question, Ashim.
No, well, I mean, it's an extremely interesting thought, and it's a very well-phrased thought, and it definitely gives you a lot to think about and work with. I agree with a lot of what Mia says. To me, though, I've said faith a few times, but to me, each book seems like a miracle.
Yeah.
You don't know where it comes from. You don't know where it's going. And I actually, obviously, you can't control how you're being received. And it's madness to think you can. And also, it's wrong to care.
Yeah.
But I think I'm now in the space where I would also think it's madness to think you could control the work you're doing. Like, you know, like even the way I said, if you had asked me 3 years ago, I was going to write a book on the plague. I don't care about the plague is what I would have said or something like this. Now
you don't care.
Well, I mean, I didn't.
But
I mean, you know, it's the plague is just a vehicle for my my career.
Use it.
Yeah, use it. You have to be there at you have to be there in front of the screen and the keyboard there every day, and you have to focus on just it being as good as it can be, but. You know, I don't know if you can control it.
Yeah, like, and in terms of that, keeping that motivation there for you to show up at the desk and at the computer each day or whatever, is it a case of doing it each day for you, or do you let time slide by, or, you know, just like, what is the process for you?
I would say now I was always at the computer for 3-4 years, and then kind of everything would happen in 3 or 4 months, and the rest of the time you were kind of messing around. So I think it's kind of becoming clear that I'm probably writing 6 months of every 18 months or 2 years. Writing is extremely draining. Your whole physiology changes.
Yeah.
You become sedentary. You can't really have fun. Maybe for other writers it's different, but for me, I can't drink, I can't go out, and I can't do these things. And then you're balancing it with having a job as well. So when you're in a moment, you've got to extend that moment, and that means solitude. Now, that is not something I can do indefinitely. It has to be in a burst of 3 months or 6 months. Editing is more enjoyable. You can kind of, you're messing around with that. But that burst of creativity, you have to respect it. Also, I used to try and spend 5 or 6 hours in front of the computer. It would drive me mental. Now I kind of realize you got 2 hours in you, and then you might have another hour later in the day. But I'm in a position now where I don't force it.
Yeah,
I wait for it to come to me.
Yeah, but do you have to kind of try all these things out, I suppose, to find find what works for you?
And it'll work for one book, and then it won't work for the next one.
Yeah, it's funny that way.
Yeah,
but you know, all of this said, I mean, Norbert did come out during the summer, and it, looking from the outside, anyway, got good reviews and well reviewed, widespread reviews, and. Well published by John Murray, so you know that must be sustaining in its own way, you know, or give you has it kind of given you a boost to see that, to experience that, or to
you must cultivate gratefulness, because like it could never happen again. You know what I mean? It could never happen again. You got to be prepared for that. I love how I've been reviewed. I got, I think, 2 or 3 wonderful reviews, that I even thought the quality of the review was excellent as well, obviously because they liked it, but no, but I did think they were excellent. And then even the negative ones, I thought they were substantially interesting. Like I was very happy with the negative reviews as well, if that makes sense. As long as you're talking about me.
And so what is next for you, Oisin, in terms of writing project, or do you have something on the go?
Yeah, I'm back in it now. Just this last 3 or 4 weeks, I changed my job, so I'm not working in the mornings. I find it flows much more naturally in the morning. So I've had half a novel done for 2 years that I've been tinkering around with, doing nothing with, and now I am writing it until Christmas, and it's a big towering mess.
Unfortunately, I think it might be another kind of historical thing. But like I said before, you don't get to choose. So I'm working on a novel and it's set on a boat. So I'll have some fun with that.
Great. Well, thanks very much for coming in today. And thanks for reading David's story for us. And wish you well with the new book.
Thank you, Declan.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to our podcast. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please share it with your friends and rate us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks very much to the Arts Council for their ongoing support of The Stinging Fly and The Stinging Fly Press.